Blog Talk Radio.
So much media, so little time. Who keeps track of it all? That would be me. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook at www.audiblepodcast.com/MRmedia. That's Mr. Media. That's where you'll find more than 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod or MP3 player. That's audiblepodcast.com/MrMedia, MRmedia. So where was I before the commercial? Right. Mr. Media is recorded live from the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. Stephen Gore already had a pretty good career going for himself when he sidestepped into the world of mystery novelist. Let me quote from Gore's own description of his life pre-novelist as a globe-trotting private eye. "It was a career that took me, among so many other places, to a smuggling port on the North China Sea, to a gambling den in Bangkok, to a prison in Lugansk, to an underground bank in Hong Kong, and to courtrooms in a dozen countries. It also put me in meetings with drug syndicates in the Golden Triangle, corrupt police officers in Mexico, sex traffickers in India, snakeheads in Taipei and San Francisco, and fraudsters from Ahmadabad, I probably got that wrong, to Zurich." Well, it sounds pretty cool to an armchair adventure seeker like me, but at some point, Gore decided to slow down and let his mind do all the work. And from his active imagination came San Francisco-based PI Graham Gage and the debut thriller Final Target. Although it weighs in at nearly 500 pages in paperback, it's a surprisingly fast read full of corporate, legal, and political intrigue. And there's a little action, too. Stephen, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
How are you today?
Good. Good. The intro of your show was so good, it got me excited to be on and to see what I had to say.
I had someone say once, they said, you know, I like that intro so much, I was eager to see who the guest was, and I realized it was me. Hey, Stephen, you made a point of telling me off the air, and I don't think I'm giving anything away, earlier this week, that this is a work of fiction. And I understood that, but I guess some people are having trouble believing that.
Yeah, people often seem to think it's really secretly autobiography, and of course it isn't. You can't use real cases in fiction. You can't use real people in fiction, and real people don't make very good characters because their identity comes out of a web of relationships in real life, and your characters come out of a web of relationships in your story, and those are really different things.
Did you find it to be a compliment that people thought it was true?
I'm not sure. I think it made my mother nervous. Because you don't tell your parents what you really do for a living in any specific way, particularly when you're a private investigator.
Well, I'm reminded of the USA Network show Burn Notice, which has Michael Weston as the lead character, and he's periodically having to reassure his mother. He's been burned, so he's in Miami, and he periodically has to reassure his mother that, oh, Mom, I'm fine. I never really do anything that would cause me to get into trouble or it'd be dangerous.
Well, actually, I've made a lot of those reassuring calls from places like Pakistan and to the folks saying, having a great time, wish you were here. Yeah, so I understand. I understand the need to reassure parents.
Well, and you actually do it in writing. It's on the very last page of the book, folks. Check this out. There's a note to the reader, and it's this and it's that. And then, oh, by the way, Mom, it's fiction. Really? I love that. Even if it was unnecessary, I still find that entertaining.
Good.
So where, in creating a book like this, where did you draw the line between you know, reality and not reality, you know, fiction.
Well, I'm not sure, you know, maybe drawing a line may not be, I think it's that the line moves depending on whether you're talking about, you know, events or characters or situations. You know, some locations in the book arise out of real, you know, real places I've been, particularly in Ukraine, London, wherever else, and the restaurant in the book where these gangsters gather really is a restaurant in Ukraine, and it looks just like that. But when it comes to characters, it's more a matter of understanding what types of people it takes to commit certain kinds of crimes, and in this case, you know, the major crimes are securities fraud and arms trafficking. And so I begin with those types and then try to create interesting characters that really are, you know, truly are products of my imagination. The main bad guy in Final Target is a fellow company president. And he was inspired not by any company president in any case I worked on, but a guy I sat next to on a long flight. And when I met him, I said, geez, that's him. That's the guy. So characters come, there's a former state security officer. You know, he's kind of inspired by people who provided my security on four rather long trips, investigative trips in Ukraine. You know, they wouldn't recognize themselves in that character, but he's inspired by them. So I guess there's lots of different lines you kind of draw in, you know, real versus fictional.
Well, one of the things you mentioned a minute ago was that the main bad guy. The thing I really liked about this is one of the things that I like about the TV show 24. I guess I'm watching too much TV already from these references. But when they start a season of 24, you know it's going to be 24 episodes. And what's interesting is in the first episode, you seem to think that you know who the bad guy is, and then 2 hours or 3 hours into it, it's changed completely. And then 3 or 4 hours after that, it evolves further. And that sort of happens in this book. Where you think you are in the first couple of chapters is not where you're going to be midway through the book or three quarters through the book or at the end of oops. Sorry. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. But,
okay. Too bad we can't roll a tape back at this point.
Yeah. But I mean that's one of the really things I think that makes it a page turner is that you may think you know what's going on, you don't know what's going on, and the characters change dramatically with time, I think.
Well, you know, the who did it question. I mean that's real investigation. You know, you go into a case, whether it was years ago investigating homicides or in, you know, later years getting into white-collar crime, you know, sometimes to figure out, you know, who even the possible bad guys are and then to determine what their roles are. You know, that kind of brings up an interesting point about what I try to do, which is to try to give the reader, since I'm not giving the reader real cases and real people and whatever, what I'm trying to do is give the reader the same experience that an investigator has investigating a case. It's a little complicated in this because there's such a close relationship between the corporate lawyer who's the first suspect and Gage himself. And where I got this is years ago there was a crime writer named Ross McDonald who was certainly, in terms of capturing the sort of the L.A. private eye in the 60s and 70s, he really got it. He really, even though he wasn't a private investigator himself, McDonald really caught what it felt like to walk down that long hallway and knock on the door and have it open and, you know, meet that person on the other side. He really got it. He understood that experience. And what I try to do in Final Target and the others that are coming is to try to give the reader that experience, but out in, you know, internationally. And there are people writing now who really capture the experience in L.A., you know, the L.A. cop with Michael Connelly and people like that. So other people, you know, are trying to – Joseph Wombat, just astounding, years ago when – I mean, so many people's reading of crime fiction began with, you know, Joseph Wombat and, you know, Tony Hillerman. But Wombat, people thought, geez, that's what life on the street is really like. Well, that's what I try to do. What it's like to, you know, knock on that door in Bangkok or, excuse me, or Bangalore or someplace like that.
The one thing I question, and it's because you have to do this in fiction, I'm guessing that a real case would not unfold quite as quickly as this one does.
No, as a matter of fact, these in real life, you know, these cases can take. And often do take years, security fraud cases. Particularly if it's an international case, it can take you a couple of years to obtain foreign documents, foreign bank documents. Though the plot in Final Target seems complicated, it really pales in comparison to what a real securities fraud looks like. The little flowcharts I include in the book to help guide the reader, imagine those multiplied, you know, 10, 20, 30 times on a single page. Then you get an idea of how these things work in the real world. And even then, you're trying to capture the essence of it for the reader, because you can't reproduce the whole real life crime of moving money through foreign bank accounts and foreign companies and using, you know, fake owners and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Stephen, in the introduction, I use your own description of, you know, the places that you've traveled to in your career as a PI and the things that you did. You know, and like I said, I refer to myself as kind of an armchair adventurer. I love to read about it, but I have no desire to do it. But I wondered, I mean, is it as exciting as people want to think it is, or is a lot of it, you know, the kind of mundaneness of anyone's job?
That's an interesting question. You know, I guess I never found it to be mundane, partly because you know, even when you're looking through bank documents to recreate a money trail, it's a hunt. And so your mind is really active. And I guess that's what keeps us from being mundane. Going to some of these places where I worked, you're carrying the case in your head the whole time. And to the extent that the case troubles you, the work isn't mundane. Certainly the pressure is there, but it never feels, I guess, ordinary. And if it's a case that's gotten lots of publicity, I had a client who was a member of parliament in Thailand, another client who was a former prime minister in Ukraine, and the case is highly political, you just never get away from it. I wouldn't say it's always exciting, but it's never ordinary and mundane. There's always that tension.
Has your past world and your current world, have they collided yet? Has the book been out long enough for them to, you know, knock into each other, where maybe clients are starting to read the book?
Oh, yeah, I've heard from clients and law firms I've worked for and other investigators I get interesting emails as people try to figure out, you know, you know, who that really was and where that really was and that sort of thing. So yeah, it is. It does collide some. You know, there's limits to how much it can collide. It can collide because it is fiction. You know, it's not. It's not.
I don't know. You keep saying that, but I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the experience that's real. Ultimately, that's what it is.
Has anyone that you did not want to recognize themselves in the book recognized themselves?
I don't think anybody is going to recognize themselves, certainly on the crook side, because, you know, there's the last line of the book, which I won't repeat, but a couple of different people I know have now taken credit for that line. not yet the person who neither well you know not not yet the still living person who said a version of that gave me the idea for the line and how to modify it for the book.
It's a great line, and it I believe it's repeated a couple times throughout the book.
Right.
Yeah. It keeps reminding you and setting the pace there. Well, let me ask you this: if people that you've known in your life as a PI haven't, you know, questioned or recognized themselves, have you had any issue with the mystery kooks who read a lot of these books? And have any of them challenged you on any of the issues in the book? When I read something like this, It's like science fiction to me. I just completely suspend disbelief. I accept all the political, the legal, you know, police, the judicial, whatever it may be. I just accept it because it's part of the fun of reading the book. That's why I enjoy, for example, the Chet the Dog books, which are, you know, supposedly written by the dog. I mean, I just,
right,
you know.
Right. Actually, I
heard
you
interview
with that
author.
Right.
You know, I just accept it for what it is. But I wondered if, you know, when you write something like this, if people come back and say, oh, come on now, that's not the way it is. You're wrong on this little, you know, point of minutia.
Actually, that hasn't happened yet. But I assume that it will. In fact, at the end I say, you know, please don't come beat me up because I, you know, had to play a little bit with geography or, you know, technology or whatever else. But I expect somebody will object to something. But actually, I'm thrilled you were able to, you know, suspend disbelief to get, you know, through the book. Because that's really the writer's challenge, is to get people to, you know, really from the first line, get them to suspend belief and get into the story.
I find it easier to do that in a novel than I do like 24, which before I said something positive about, but I'll say something negative about it too. And that, you know, I drives my wife crazy. I will scream at the screen sometimes because something is just so inane. It's so unlikely. It's so stupid. But it, you know, there's things you got to do to move the plot forward. I understand that, I guess.
Right. And there is a, yeah, and there is kind of a compromise between the real-life investigation and fictional investigation, which was a hard lesson for me to learn in writing, which is that in investigation, you meet somebody, you interview somebody, you keep the tension you keep in your head. You never lay it on the table. You know, you don't get people to talk to you through intimidation or threats or anger or voice raising and all that. It's creating an environment, an opportunity for them to talk. So you feel the tension in your head, but it's not on the table. But for readers, they've got to see it out there. They've got to see the tension and the conflict and whatever else. And to that extent, there is kind of a compromise with reality. Certainly, the best investigators I've ever met, if they raise tension in an interrogation or an interview, it's for some really strategic person, and they only do it, you know, very few times in their careers. But in fiction, you've got to see the potential tension in the situation and then show it to the reader in some more sort of graphic and physical way. And so in a certain way, it's a compromise with reality. In another way, it's a way to sort of bring forth the potential of reality in a way that a reader can understand it.
A couple things I noticed, and they were very slight, but they stuck out at me. You got in a kind of a backhanded slap at George W. Bush late in the book, and I wondered if anyone had responded to that.
Which are you referring to?
I knew you were going to ask me. Okay, I've got it here. It's page 362, and let's see, who says this? I guess this is it Slava? Wait a minute. It's Ninchenko. Ninchenko. He says, Hadion Alexandrovich got some things on his own and some things he got because people thought they were paying off his father. Not that different than what the European press used to say about the second George Bush and his oil interests. I thought, ooh, zing.
Well, that's one of these factual things.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, traveling around, you read that in the press, and you certainly heard it
right.
from business people that you know they're applying their own experience, particularly in Central Europe, profoundly corrupt, and China, profoundly corrupt. They say, well, father, son. Well, we know how that works. And so, yeah, that's where
yeah.
that came from. So it's not me making that comment. It's something that the characters need to think about and do think about as they try to position themselves in the world and understanding, connecting, and trying to describe to Gage how they view their own leaders. And by something that they think he may, you know, understand.
Right. No, I agree. And I don't care what your personal politics are, one way or the other. It struck me as interesting that if you didn't feel that way, it would have been very easy two sentences to leave out. On the other hand, if you did feel that way, it's a very subtle way to get a little dig in.
Right. Well, one thing I try to do in this book, and even more in the next book, this is a book called Absolute Risk that comes out in the fall, is I make characters, a lot of characters outsiders, and put them in kind of cross cultural situations, so there's a reader gets a sense of how you know we look to foreigners and also to articulate how foreigners look to us. Gage is a guy who starts out in southern Arizona and ends up as a detective in San Francisco, and basically an outsider in the city. Birch is the lawyer is an Australian who moved here to work. Gage's wife Faith is an anthropologist because there's so much potential in sort of that having somebody who can take a cross-cultural view of things.
So what was it that prompted you, as you put it, to put your PI license in the drawer and become a novelist?
Well, I think I kind of had enough, on the one hand, I kind of had done everything or most everything there is to do in the investigative world. And I had gotten, in the last year that I was working full-time and not devoting part of my time to writing, I spent 6 months out of the country, another 2 months on the road within the country. During that period, I was gone for, you know, as long as 2 months at a time. You know, one trip I arranged to meet my wife in Hong Kong, another trip in London. And she's an investigator, too, so she spent her career doing the same thing. And 6 months and, you know, it just was enough. And, I got to the office one day for an early conference call, with people at inconvenient time zones. And they're at, 5:15 in the morning have the call. And then I said to myself, gee, you know, maybe I should write a novel. And once you start, you can't stop. And so I drafted out a couple of sort of rough outlines of books, and Final Target came out of one of those outlines. And I realized I really enjoyed sitting at my computer and, you know, making things up. You know, investigative world is all about facts. You're a success to the extent that you find facts and are able to reproduce them accurately for your client. In my case, it was always law firms, regardless of what side the issue on. It was always law firms, and so your success is factual. It's did you find the facts? Did you find the person? Did you get them to talk to you? Did you, and what did they tell you? And you've got to get it exactly right, because that statement is going to end up as testimony someday, whether it's in a deposition in some foreign country and or a courtroom in the United States.
And what was I going to ask you? Has your business day changed a lot since switching careers? I mean, do you have the same routine, or is it very, very different?
Oh, it's very different. Most of the day is spent writing. And I have the kinds of cases I'm doing now are very few and local. And when I finish them up, I'll probably be done, except for one or two lawyers who I really like to work with. Because I discovered something interesting as I was making this transition, that I needed to be on the street sometimes to recreate for myself that feeling of tension, and it made my writing better to knock on a door once in a while, and and go to bad places, and lawyers, believe me, are always willing to send me to bad places. So that really helps. So I've been keeping my hand in a little, but my day is, 6 o'clock in the morning, I'm at my computer. And if it's a writing phase rather than editing or doing other things related to the writing or research, then I write till I get my 500 or 1,000 words done. Then I'm free to do whether, the personal stuff or the investigative work. But, if something important has to be done in some investigative case, obviously I'll put off the writing. But sometime during that day, I'm going to get those 500 or 1,000 words done.
Right. Well, we're just about out of time. I was going to ask you what's next, but I think you mentioned it's a new book called Absolute Risk that'll be out in the fall.
Right. It'll be out in the fall. I just did the copy edits, also from HarperCollins, who I got to say have just been spectacular. Particularly when, you've got a new writer, they don't know whether their book is going to sell. And they, you've got publicity people that are helping you, and copy editors are going over things word by word and saving you, trust me, tremendous embarrassment by catching things. So they're kind enough to publish another one in the fall, and then we've got another one scheduled for next year.
Well, folks, listen, you can find Stephen Gore's current book, Final Target, which I recommend, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it online at MrMedia.com, MRMedia.com. You can also learn more about PI-turned-novelist Stephen Gore at his website, which is simply www.Stephen, that's with a V, Stephen Gore, GORE.com. Stephen, any book signings or appearances coming up, or can people find you on the usual Twitter, Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
Just through my website. I have a talk scheduled for later this month in Sacramento for a very interesting group called Sisters in Crime. It's a nationwide organization. They have a chapter up there. And then I'll be for a couple days at the Central California Writers Conference the following month. So I'm looking forward to doing both those things.
Great. Well, Stephen, it was a lot of fun to read the book, and almost as much fun talking to you.
See, fiction is better than life, isn't it?
Hey, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving up your time, and good luck, and come back, you know, when the next one comes out.
Okay, thank you very much for taking the time to interview me. I really appreciate it. And certainly you've enjoyed your other interviews, particularly with the author of the dog books. I really got it.
Tell him. He wasn't too happy.
Oh, okay.
He wasn't very happy about that, yeah. Oh, well. anyway, Stephen, thank you, and we'll talk to you maybe next time the next
Great.
Book comes out.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. All right.
Bye-bye.
And bye-bye. Folks, for more interviews with your favorite novelists, you can surf over to our main website, www.mrmedia.com. That's where you can listen to my earlier conversations with Adriana Trigiani, Dolan Perkins-Valdez, Sarah Zarr, James Dashner, Richard Deutsch, Monty Schultz, Lisa McMahon, Peter Gallenbach, John Darton, Suanne Jafarian, James Sheehan, and many more. Subscribe to Mr. Media on iTunes, and you'll never miss a show. Just search Mr. Media Interviews from within iTunes and subscribe for free. You can also listen with a piece of string and a tin can in many locations. If you've got an idea for a guest, email me directly at bob@andelman.com. You can also follow me on Facebook or on Twitter, www.twitter.com/andelman or facebook.com/andelman. Thanks so much for joining us today. Always appreciate it when you give up a little piece of your day and spend it with us. Thanks for listening, everybody.